Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Iran Brooks Show on this Monday evening. And today we're doing what we do every month. I have some of my best supporters from Patreon on video conference with me through Zoom, and they get to ask me questions. We'll also take questions from anybody who got a access phone number to Zoom to be able to ask questions through there. I've also got a couple of written questions, and of course, we always take questions from the Super Chat. So if you have access to YouTube and you'd like to ask a question, you can ask the question through Super Chat. So, and we'll see if there's time and if there's interest. I will maybe even give you a phone number, just open it up generally for phone calls and get some numbers that day. You'll get the phone number. If you contribute $25 a month on Patreon, you get a phone number. If you don't, you don't. You know, there's perks to actually being a supporter of the Iran Brooks Show. Otherwise, you can use a Super Chat, and I might give up a more direct phone number afterwards. We'll see. All right, but what we're going to do is I'm going to actually start with a written question that I got from one of my primary supporters here on Patreon. So this is for you, David. And after that, I'll bounce between Jennifer and Darius. I've got one other written question, but we'll do this one first. And the question is about the walkaway movement, and I'll talk about what the walkaway movement is in a minute. He says, the walkaway movement is an interesting phenomenon. What are its implications? Does it have legs? What are its implications? Does it have legs? So what is the walkaway movement? I mean, until a few weeks ago, I had never heard of the walkaway movement. And I don't know if how many of you have, but the walkaway movement is a movement that, I mean, I don't know if it's a movement, but it's a phenomena on YouTube primarily, where people have basically given up on the left and have abandoned the Democratic Party and the leftists. And what they're doing is they're posting videos explaining why they have given up on the left and the fact that they're walking away from the left. Many of them, I guess, are becoming Republicans or more of the right, but many of them are just, I think, recognizing they have no affiliation, but they are abandoning the left. And whoops, we lost Jennifer there, so I'm not sure what happened. Maybe she'll dial back. This is people walking away from the left. The people who primarily, I'd say, over issues related to free speech, over issues related to just generally the nuttiness of the nihilistic left. So these are people that are abandoning, abandoning the nihilism, but also banning the wackiness, the intersectionality, the pandering to anything any supposed oppressed group has. I think post Kavanaugh, some additional people joined the walkaway movement. Now, I have no idea, and I don't think anybody has an idea how big this is. There are a lot of videos. There's a lot of retweeting on Twitter. For a while, there were rumors that I think the left spread that the retweets on Twitter were all Russian bots, or I don't know, maybe not Russian bots, maybe Chinese bots. Who knows whose bots they were? But people have done, it looks like people have done some research, and that's not true. There was just a lot of retweeting. But again, it's hard to tell how big this is, and it's hard to tell who's retweeting, and it's hard to tell exactly what's going on, because you're dependent on watching the videos and counting them. So it's not a good set. But I would say this. I suspect that there are a lot of these people. And I'm not sure why it's being called a walkaway. I guess the first video was by a guy who defined the movement as the walkaway movement, and people have picked up the hashtag. It's hashtag, you can get up on Twitter, hashtag walkaway. But I identified this phenomena well before the walkaway movement. I identified it probably, 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when I first did the Dave Rubin show. And of course, Dave Rubin, if you will, is the first walkaway. And he's done a video about why he left the left. And when I did the Dave Rubin show 2.5 years ago, the response I got was so overwhelmingly positive. The number of Twitter followers, the number of people who started following me was so large. I mean, we're talking about well over 1,000 new people just, you know, signed onto my account, both on Facebook and on Twitter, and it was huge. And these were not people who had necessarily read Ayn Rand. These were not people who were objectivists. These were people who were, for the most part, former leftists, but had a respect for reason and science. And I've been saying for a long time now that, in my view, probably our best audience out there in terms of, if you will, converting or in terms of bringing on board to our ideas, are people on the left who are not the nihilist left, are not the wacky left, are not the crazy left, are not the egalitarian left, but people on the left who still have a respect for science and reason and who have not identified themselves with the right, primarily because they view the right as religious, they view the right as dogmatic, they view the right as anti-reason, anti-science, and also because they lack an understanding of economics and the principles of individual rights and other important political principles. But I think that if you accept reason, even if you have a false definition of reason, but if you accept the idea of reason, then we can work with you. At least a certain percentage of those people can be worked with. If your whole basis for knowledge of the world out there is faith, if your whole basis for knowledge out there is a dichotomized mind in which accepts faith and a big part of it and accepts reason, I guess, when they go to work, but it doesn't have this commitment to reason, it's much harder. So I've always said that there's an element within the left, call it center left, pro-reason, pro-science. I call it the Dave Rubin audience. Or another way to think about it is the intellectual dark web. I mean, think about most of the people in the intellectual dark web are people who, in a sense, have signed up to walk away, like the Weinstein brothers and many of these people. They're not that they become objectivists. They certainly have not. Right? They're not even capitalists. But they have rejected the wackiness of the left. And for the most part, they even reject the Democratic Party for supporting the wackiness of the left. So you're seeing an intellectual dark web, which was the precursor to walkaway. You're seeing Dave Rubin, who was the precursor for walkaway. And I think what the left is doing right now, and I think this explains Trump, but it also explains walkaway, and it also explains, I think, a real opportunity for objectivists, is the left is so nutty, is so wacko, is so postmodernist crazy, that they are basically rejecting or they are turning away a lot of people that we have an opportunity to pick up. They're turning away a lot of people that I think respect reason and science and therefore cannot respect the kind of Antifa tactics or cannot respect the identity politics or cannot respect the whole idea of intersectionality. They just cannot respect the nuttiness, the nihilism, the real nihilism of so much of the left. Oh, Jennifer's back. That's good. And as a consequence of that, I think there's a real opportunity for objectivism, for those of us who advocate for reason and science, but consistently advocate for reason and science, to at least offer an alternative to the worldview that these people hold to one extent or another. So what are its implications? The implications are that I think the left is actually losing power. I think that I think that the people turning against the left, and I think that if there was a legitimate alternative to the left, not objectivist, but not the Republican Party of Donald Trump, but if there was a legitimate, pro-reason, thoughtful, interesting alternative to the left, I think it would do very well today. I think a political party that rejects the wacky, the socialist, egalitarian, the anti-business, I mean, the vehemently anti-business attitudes of today, the Democratic Party and the whole leftist agenda, and had some respect for individuals, had respect for the mind, had respect for science, it didn't pander to the anti-evolutionaries, it didn't pander to religion. I think that political party would do fantastically well today, and I think it's an opportunity to capture the walkaways in such a party, but also as part of the intellectual dark web, and hopefully some of them can be captured in favor of objectivism, in favor of ultimately the ultimate philosophy of reason. So I view this as wonderful news, as a real opportunity. Thanks, David, for pointing this out. I do think it has legs. I think you'll actually see this grow as the left becomes more consistently nihilistic. And I've often said that I don't think the left can win. I don't think the left can win totally. That is, dominate American society and dominate American culture. It's too damn crazy. And Americans are not crazy. So Americans will not give up to the extent of accepting nihilism. They'll accept pragmatism, like the pragmatism we're seeing from Donald Trump, but I don't think they're quite ready to accept nihilism. All right, that's a walkaway question. Let me then go to Jennifer and take a question for you, and then we'll do Darius, and we've got a super chat question, and I've got one more written question, and we kind of circulate around that way. Go, Jennifer.
Can you explain the difference between a stolen concept and a package deal?
You need to warn me in advance for questions like that. Oh, my God.
You want to do it next time?
Let me see if I can handle this, right? And forgive me if I get it wrong. But a stolen concept is a concept that is being used in a way that is antagonistic to its actual meaning. It's the opposite of what its actual meaning is. A package deal is a concept that people hold to actually possess A and non-A as well, or A and B as well. That is, two things that are dramatically different. And of course, you want an example. And you guys can't ask me questions in epistemology at 8 p.m. on a Monday evening, unprepared. That is just not damn fair. But look, so much of what's around us, right? So much of the concept we use is a package deal. Take a concept I talked about yesterday called nationalism. Well, nationalism, the way it is used today, is a package deal. It's a package deal which some people, when they hear Donald Trump say nationalism, they jump and say, yes, finally a president who loves America, right? So it's a package deal of loving America with everything that implies, individual rights and freedom of speech and so on, right? And at the same time, it is the Nazis coming marching, a blood and soil, everything for the state. We're willing to sacrifice the individual. And the way most people hold nationalism, it's a vague approximation of both of those. They hold both in their minds. And when Donald Trump says I'm a nationalist, both things, I think, I mean, they accept this package deal of, if they accept what Donald Trump is saying, that holds both these elements within it, right? Both the element of a good kind of nationalism, which is very rare. Almost nobody holds this Americanism. And I'll give another plug to Jonathan Honing's new book, it's based on Ayn Rand's essay, on Americanism, and with a lot of essays. Americanism is the appropriate form of nationalism. It is a respect and an adoration and a love for America qua as the founders established it. That is America as a protector of individual rights. But also packaged in there is not just Americanism, but also packaged in there is all the muck about sacrificing self for state, the importance of the American soil and the American people. And this is a president who talks a lot about American jobs, and a president who talks about, which is again, as if there's such a thing as an American job, versus any other kind of job. That the primacy is on America rather than the primacy of on the idea that makes America possible. So you see that two different views of nationalism, that when somebody like Trump talks about nationalism, he confuses the two, he mushes the two together, and that's the package deal. The package deal is the good and the bad together in the same file folder, together in the same conceptual framework. Or take the term selfishness, which is a classic package deal. Selfishness includes both the idea of Steve Jobs building the iPhone for himself because he loves it and because he wants to make lots and lots of money. So he was selfish because he was trying to make his life better, right? But together with the concept in that fault folder of selfishness is also the idea that selfish means lying, cheating, SOB, that he'll do anything and exploit anybody and use anybody in order to achieve his means. And then, so when somebody says selfish, what pops out to them is, yes, yeah, Steve Jobs, oh, but also lying, cheating, stealing, SOB. So selfish is this mixture, and what it does conceptually is it taints the one with the other. That is, now every time I think of Steve Jobs, I think, but he's selfish, but selfish is also lying, cheating, stealing, SOB. So he must be maybe tainted with the lying, stealing, SOB. And I can't separate them out because they all fall under the same concept. And that's the damage package deals do, is they make it impossible for you to use the concept appropriately, because the concepts are unifiers. They unify all the things that are similar in an important way together. And when you pollute that, it's hard to use the concept. So we've polluted the concept of selfishness, and to some extent we polluted a proper conception of nationalism. And it could be, and this is the problem with the term nationalism, it could be that the concept was a bad concept to begin with and we should have never adopted it. But Ayn Rand said some positive things about a way in which nationalism could be appropriate. And, so I'll give her the benefit of the doubt in the sense that I'll assume there's a positive use for the term nationalism. And really that term is Americanism. That is what Jonathan is talking about in his new book. A stolen, I right now my brain is freezing over in terms of an example for stolen concept. So let me get back to you on the stolen concept. My guess is that a lot of stolen concepts are also package deals, but the overlap is not 100%.
Thank you.
So I'll get back to you on the stolen concept. All right, Darius. There you go.
Thanks, Ron.
Sure.
So my question is about externalities.
Yep.
You spoke about these a few months ago. And correct me if I got it wrong. I think what you said was that you acknowledge they are possible, such as in environmental issues.
Sure.
But there should only be laws related to them if the damages can be established with high certainty.
Yes.
Did I paraphrase that correctly?
Yes. I mean, the standard should be a legal standard. That is, you have to be able to prove that you've actually had damages, or the government agency responsible for protecting us from air pollutants that might harm us has to be able to prove, in a sense, in a court of law, that the thing is really damaging, that there is science behind it, that it is factual.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. Because today, it's almost random what they use. I mean, it's like on a regular basis, they come up with these this and this thousandth of a milligram, the, you know, and we think that maybe in some hypothetical situations it could cause you to be sick. Well, if you can't prove it, if you can't show that it's actually dangerous, you can't ban it. It's a, you know, the precautionary principle today in regulatory science is that you're not going to use anything unless you know that it's safe. But how do you know something is safe, right? I mean, it's an impossible standard by which to evaluate stuff. Until you try it, you can't even know that it's completely safe. So it's a way to shut down all progress, the precautionary principle, to create such a high barrier that progress doesn't happen. Did you want to follow up on that? Yeah, go ahead.
Would you say externalities, the term is in some ways is becoming an anti-concept?
Externality is an anti-concept. I mean, in a sense, it captures something real, right? It captures the effect that your actions have on a bystander when that bystander has no relation to you, right? He has no contractual relation with you. He didn't ask for this. Now, so you pollute and pollute in order to produce something, and you have a contract with somebody, and there's a third party somewhere, and they are damaged by the fact that you are spewing stuff out. And there's no contractual relationship between you and them. They're a third party. The impact you have on them, you can call externality. I think it's a legitimate concept. I'd have to think about it further, but I think it's a legitimate concept. But you also have to remember that most externality, the overwhelming majority of externalities, are positive externalities. That is, every day you do things that benefit dozens, hundreds, thousands, millions of people without maybe them even knowing it, that you do not get compensated for, that you do not intend to benefit them. It's not your intention to benefit them, but you are because, I don't know, you're helping to make prices more efficient in the market. Darius manages money. You're helping make prices more efficient in the market, which improves allocation of capital throughout the economy, which millions of people benefit from the fact that the allocation of capital is more efficient in the marketplace. And without people like you actually trading and actually trying to make money, then markets would not be efficient and distribution of capital would be inefficient and therefore they would lose money. So you could say that your trading actually has a positive externality on the world. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Or, you know, a beautiful woman walks down the street, positive externality, at least for me. I like looking and it puts a smile on my face maybe, and I say, cool. And that's a positive externality. She didn't do it for me, and I, you know, I have no relationship, but I got a smile on my face. So a little kid, a little cute little three-year-old dawdling down the street and make my day. Yeah, how cute is that? You know, that's a positive externality. I something positive happened to me, not through any kind of formal relationship, not because anybody intended that positive thing happened to me. And in that sense, positive externalities are all over the place. Or you know, right now, you're seeing some beautiful artwork in the background there. Not my intention necessarily that's not why you came, but you're getting an added plus, right? That, by the way, over there, that one over there is Vermeer, the geographer, one of my favorite paintings. Any follow-up, Darius?
No, thank you.
All right. Let me take this super chat question, and then I'll go back to Jennifer. Hi, Iran. Do you think America's foreign policy was correct during World War II? Do you think the U.S. should have stepped in before Pearl Harbor? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this either way. I think this is a tough one, particularly not having lived through it and not really having studied it in great detail. I can tell you that Ayn Rand objected to entering World War II before Pearl Harbor, and indeed believed that FDR kind of, in some ways, encouraged the Japanese or what do you call it? oh, I don't know the exact term, but kind of prodded the Japanese to attack us so that he could enter World War II. I think both Ayn Rand and Leonard Peikoff believe that that's what happened, and that World War II, U.S. involvement with World War II was primarily something that FDR wanted and a consequence of FDR's views. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with them. I think that the United States would have been in a very weak position had Pearl Harbor not happened, had the Japanese taken over the whole of Southeast Asia, had the Nazis being able to take over all of Europe. Now, there are other elements here that I think are important. And this I agree with Ayn Rand on. Ayn Rand claimed that if the United States had not helped the Soviet Union, if the United States had not supplied Stalin, that and if the United States had stayed out of the war, not entered the Western Front, that Stalin and Hitler would have basically been engaged in years and years and years of war, annihilating each other. And in a sense, we would have managed to get rid of both the communists and the fascists and the Nazis in the same fell swoop, because they basically would have killed each other. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So I'm very supportive. I do not believe, and I generally hold this, that the enemy of thy enemy is my friend. I do not believe we should have helped the Soviets to defeat the Nazis. I do not believe we should have supported the Saudis in order to defeat Iraq, or support the Saudis today under Trump and Obama in order to protect us from Iran. I do not think the enemy of thy enemy is my friend, and I don't believe in treating them that way. I believe you do whatever you can to annihilate whoever is truly your enemy and is a true threat to you, and you deal with, you deal with all enemies. You don't just choose the enemy that you don't play nice with the people who are still your enemies, but enemies of your greater enemy. Saudi Arabia and Iran come to mind right now. Both are enemies. Both should be treated by enemies. Now, the challenge with World War II, I think, and again, it's hard to rewrite history. What would have happened if the U.S. had not supported the Soviet Union? But part of the challenges with World War II is that it is possible, although, that the Germans would have been able to develop nuclear weapons. And that would have been horrific if the Germans had, because the Germans were one of these regimes that would actually maybe even use them against America, certainly against England and maybe even against America. Now, you could argue that they wouldn't have, and certainly the United States would have developed its nuclear program much faster than Germany, so it would have had nukes first. But whether the U.S. would have entered the war and used those nukes, so we can play all kinds of hypotheticals. But generally, my approach is this. I don't believe the U.S. should enter a war unless it is a clearly preemptive war, and there's clear reason to believe that it is needed in order to protect the lives and property of Americans right now, or that there's clear evidence that the enemy is getting stronger and it would be easier to win the war right now. Right? So, for example, and another factor should be, is the war winnable quickly and easily with minimal casualties? I mean, that's a war that I'm much more likely to approve of than a war that's going to take 5 years to win. And of course, I'm not talking about winning like the today with the stupid rules of engagement and the completely sacrificial way in which we fight wars. So I'm talking about fighting a real war. So, I don't have a good answer about World War II, because I think you'd have to ask too many questions. And the main question is, if you don't help the Soviet Union, what happens to Hitler's army and the Soviet army even before it's relevant whether the United States enters the war or not? Both are so weakened that I'm not sure there's any point in the United States entering, and it could be at that point that the Brits can take much of it. But it's really hard to tell. Rewriting history is difficult. the challenge is, how do you learn from history, figure out the principles that work, and apply them to the present and the future. And I think you can learn a lot from World War II about what not to do and how not to fight wars and how, yes, to fight wars. Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a great way to end a war quickly and with minimal casualties. And I'm a big supporter of using nuclear weapons when appropriate, when it can end a war quickly, thoroughly, unequivocally, with minimal casualties to your side. I don't think that's always, but I think when it's appropriate, they should be used. All right. Wow. I've got a fan in Kuwait who just sent some money over Super Chat. Thanks, Al, I guess. Al or Ali. Or Al, I don't know. Thanks. Appreciate the following. Okay. Let's see. Jennifer, question?
Yes. Do you think it's ever correct to say that the perfection is the enemy of the good? Like at my job, the upper management is always complaining no matter how much money we make. And it's like, I know you want to improve, but it doesn't mean you should be perpetually dissatisfied, does it?
So they're always complaining about, that
how much money we make. It's never good enough. They're always...
I see. It's never enough. It's never enough. I thought they were complaining they're making too much money. You never know these days. The question is, why are they complaining, right? Are they complaining because they set realistic goals and they haven't been able to meet them? And that's perfection. Perfection is to set realistic goals and to meet them. Or are they setting unrealistic goals, ridiculous goals, really, really high goals, and then failing to meet them and being upset? And that's not an issue of perfection. That's an issue of setting unrealistic goals. That is, perfection cannot be external to reality. Perfection is not some kind of platonic ideal that one gets in the afterlife or in another dimension if one meditates long enough or if one, somehow consults with the world of forms. Perfection is the best one can attain, truly the best one can attain. Being rational, the best one can attain in this world, given the facts of and the knowledge available to us today, right? So... the standard is not the most money I can think of or the most money I can imagine. The standard is what is realistically possible to achieve in terms of making money in the businesses we are in, given the personnel that we have and given where we are today. And if that personnel and everything else is not good enough, then how do I change all that to make but a realistic goal? If a goal is not realistic, then what's the point, right? The goal, so it's wrong to set as perfection a standard that's unattainable, okay? And if that's the case, if you set such a standard, then yeah, perfection is the enemy of the good, but perfection shouldn't be the enemy of the good. Perfection should be the good. And aiming for perfection means constantly trying to be better. But aiming for something that's realistic for you to aim for. There's no point in creating... I mean, I think Leonard Peikoff talks about this. I can't remember in OPA, but certainly in one of these courses, he talks about this issue of... Oh, when he talks about the virtue of pride. So the virtue of pride is that you are... that you strive towards moral perfection. That's what pride means. Pride means the achievement of moral perfection, the striving towards moral perfection, right? But if moral perfection is unattainable, then pride is impossible, and therefore the virtues all fall apart. But if virtue, as it is in the objectivist ethics, is realistic in a sense that it's connected to reality and it is achievable to human beings, because basically what virtue means is to be rational in every aspect of one's life, then to be a perfect human being is to be a rational human being. And one should strive towards that. And one should try to be as perfect as one can. And to the extent when one is not rational, one should fix it. But in that context, the perfect is not enemy of the good. The perfect is what drives the good to be good. The perfect is the goal of the good. The perfect is what is trying to be. But if you set the standard as unrealistic, as detached from reality, then you can't get to the being good. Is video down? Can you guys hear me though?
I can see you, but you're stuck.
I'm stuck?
Yeah.
All right. I'm not sure what's going on. Let's see. There we go. We've got some video back. Okay. Well, video's in and out, it looks like.
Oh, you're back.
Am I back?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Somehow the stop video button got clicked. I don't think it was me. Anyway. So is that clarifying in terms of perfection?
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, too many people set standards of perfection that are unattainable, and therefore they can never, you know, they can never achieve it, and therefore they're stuck. And that's when you say the enemy of perfection is the enemy of the good. But that's only in cases where you've set a false standard of perfection. Okay.
I think that's what they're doing.
Yes. Well, I assume so. If the unit is working hard, and if everybody's being productive as they can be, and management is doing the right things to make as much money as they can, then yeah, then if you can't make any more money, then demanding more than you can do is a barrier, because it demotivates. Psychologically, it's very destructive. But there are people who are perfectionists and who have a really hard time with this concept, because they set themselves up a standard that is unattainable, and therefore they are never happy because they're always striving towards the unattainable. All right, Darius.
Yeah. What do you think about making an index for your work, for your podcasts and your videos, your episodes?
So there is a beginnings of an index, and I think it covers most of my shows. I don't know if it's updated to cover all of them on my Facebook page. So if you go to the Yaron Brooks Show Facebook page, not on my Facebook page, Yaron Brooks Show Facebook page, the first entry is an index. So try it out. But yeah, I think it's a great idea, and I'm glad somebody did it. As long as I don't have to do it, it's a great idea, because it's a lot of work, because I cover a lot of topics. Do you see it?
So I'm on the page.
Go down. The first entry in the, maybe the second entry in the Yaron Brooks Show, should be an index. And those of you interested, it's facebook.com/Yaron Brooks Show, I think. Oh, not there. Yeah, here we go. It's this entry by Mark Calderon. He's created a Google Docs, which has all past episodes, and each episode there's actually a listing of all the topics covered in that. So it's not exactly an index, but at least it's a list of every topic I've ever covered on a show in a Google Doc available to everybody.
That is great. Thank you.
So do you see it on the Facebook page? Maybe you're not a member. Are you a member of the Yaron Brooks Show Facebook page?
I should be. I'll find it.
Okay. So it's the first post that I see. It's kind of pinned to the top.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Sure. Question? Other than that? That was too easy.
That's it.
All right. Let me take this written question by Roy. Roy says, I mean, this is a question I don't really have an answer to, but I'll tell you why I don't have an answer to. And I'm not sure. I'm not exactly sure what the question is, but I'll try. Roy's on the chat on YouTube, so he can clarify. How would someone in finance, like hedge funds, quants and non-quant, bond funds, insurance companies, large banks, etc., how would they use labor market data, such as live unemployment data of a certain country, to make investment decisions? I'd also appreciate if you could provide examples of firms that do this. Firms that invest in emerging markets such as Latin America, the Caribbean, Africa, and Asia, as well as developing markets such as Northern. Okay. Okay, let me just say, I'm not going to provide examples of firms that do this, partially because I can't remember their names, and partially because I don't want to recommend any particular hedge funds or money managers other than Darius, of course, because he invests money. But he will, you know, but I don't want to endorse anybody. I haven't done the research. All you'll get is my bias, what I remember and what I don't remember, which is not reflective of anything other than my memory. So I don't want to try to recall hedge funds and other types of funds that do this, but a lot of funds do this. There's a ton of funds out there that invest in emerging markets. There's a ton of funds that invest in Latin America, anywhere from index funds that do this to active managers who are trying to beat the market. Good luck to them on that, but that are trying to beat the market. And some have been successful in the past. Why and how are you successful is a question that you can ask, which is an interesting question. We got Darius, he has an opinion about this. We can debate it a little bit, but the fact is that, so I don't want to name any names, but there are a lot of them. You can go to Fidelity, and Fidelity has a Latin America fund, and Fidelity has an emerging market fund. And again, some of them are index funds and some of them are stock, because the same with Vanguard, the same with any mutual fund company. I think even dimensional funds, the DCM have emerging market funds. I think they do.
They do.
Yeah, and they take a more index approach to emerging markets as well. Although they have a tilted index, so they tilt the index based on certain factors that they have shown to do as well as the market or maybe a little bit better. And then in terms of hedge funds, same thing. But then you're asking, how would in finance somebody like hedge funds or all these other funds use labor market data? Look, everybody who's a fundamentalist, everybody who's trying to analyze, certainly if they're macro investors trying to invest based on economics, they all have used different models, and those different models, a lot of those different models have labor market data embedded in those models. The problem with labor market data is that everybody has it. And therefore, to the extent that it gives you an advantage, it gives lots of people an advantage in quotes. And therefore, everybody trades it as soon as it becomes available. So unless you have inside information, unless you know about it beforehand, you don't have any specific advantage. You just get the information where everybody else gets it. You try and trade, but it's already priced because everybody's moved the prices together at the same time. Now, you know, so it's rare that somebody has a better way to interpret something as common as labor market data in a way that would give them an edge. Now, it could be that in certain emerging markets, I don't know, Liberia, I don't even know if they have a stock exchange. It's so inefficient. There's so few players. There's so few people investing in that stock market. Now, already that suggests there's a lot of risk. So you got to be wary of the returns you get. There might be just compensation for the fact that it's illiquid and it's highly risk. You might have an advantage if you have additional information about labor markets in Liberia, which are not publicized easily and are not available easily. And then you've got, in a sense, special information. But I don't think labor market data in America, in a U.S. market, in a European market, in a market that is heavily monitored, heavily traded, very liquid, and where everybody's looking at the same data. What advantage do you have when you get that? You have no advantage. So I agree that it could be possible in certain emerging markets where you might have a competitive advantage relative to the other players because they haven't entered the space. But even in the more traded emerging markets, the typical emerging markets, I don't know, that most of these big funds participate in, you would have to have some special sauce, which I don't think, obviously most people don't have, it's unusual to have, in order to be able to make money off of that kind of data. I'll give you an example of data that hedge funds try to use to give them an advantage. I was just talking to somebody the other day who provides such data. For example, there's a satellite company that provides hedge funds, certain hedge funds, with satellite images of malls. Now, why would hedge funds care about satellite images of malls? They use that in order to estimate the number of people shopping. That is, if parking lots are empty, and particularly in particular regions, if parking lots are empty or parking lots are full are parking lots empty every day? Are they full every day? You might be able to judge particular regions that are strong economically, or at least strong economically from consumption. Now, how you exactly trade that, that's beyond me. You'd have to ask the specific hedge fund guys. But I can imagine, or I don't know, if you could track trucking. Trucking is a huge leading indicator for economic activity. Like when trucking slows down, it means goods are being shipped around less. Maybe there's less imports and exports. If you could have an edge, if you could get the data about trucking movements around the country, the volume of trucking before anybody else, I don't know, using satellite images, let's say, that would give you an edge. In other words, the only way to make money in a market is if you truly have an informational edge over other participants in the market, or you have a strategy that is that the market is not identified yet, and you have you're ahead of the market in the use of a strategy. You know, and again, I think it's arguably how you do that and so on. But if you're interested in this, I mean, there's a blog I follow, which I think it's one of the best. And I don't know if Darius, if you read Cliff Asness from AQR, but Cliff is a Chicago trained economist, or Chicago trained finance PhD, who studied with Farmer, who is the big advocate for efficient markets, but runs AQR, one of the largest institutional investors in the world, both hedge funds and other types of money management, but very similar to dimensional funds. Dimensional funds is run by another student of Farmer's, David Booth. And David Booth and Cliff Asness run somewhat similar strategies from different perspectives, with different clients and a different way of doing it. But it's really fascinating to read his stuff and the way he views efficient markets and the way he views the factors that go into valuing stocks. And so if you really want to do that, that's one of the people I would track would be Cliff Asness. Just looking him up on Twitter, looking up in Google, you'll find his stuff. And the firm is AQR, which is one of the large money managers in the world. But, you know, so that's really what I have to say about this. I mean, you can't ask, you know, these kind of, I mean, this is what one of my professors told me once when, somebody asked, how do you make money in the market? And he said, I mean, his primary message was, if I knew, I wouldn't tell you. Because as soon as you tell people, it's gone. As soon as you tell people, it's gone. There used to be something called the January effect. There is no January effect anymore. People saw it. What happened in January is most of the returns of the S&P 500 in any given year were mostly in January. So the best trade to be made, given that stock markets usually go up mostly in a year, is to buy at the beginning of January and sell at the end of January. And you'd make most of what was made that year, and you could have trading strategy to exploit all this, But once people realize that the January effect exists, it goes away. It disappears. And there are lots of these effects that go away over time. There are also, there are different factors that determine stock market prices, and it's very difficult. It's very difficult to be a good investor. There's only a handful of people that in the modern investing world that have over very long periods of time managed to beat the market to do well. There's a handful of them, and if you go and look at the analysis of how they did it, it's interesting. I encourage you to go and look at their analysis and see. But a lot of it is just, buy and hold. And buy and hold with a bit of an edge. It doesn't take much to beat the market, or unique knowledge that nobody else has. Yeah. All right. You want to add anything to that, Darius? I know that... this is a topic you're interested in. No, okay. You there?
You're on?
Yeah. You there?
Yeah.
Okay.
You froze up for me there. Yeah.
Okay.
Were you talking to me?
I just said if you wanted to add anything.
Yeah, yeah, thank you.
Sure.
No, I mean, you nailed it. That was great. I mean, the market's very efficient for all practical purposes. And, I would, if the person asked the question, I would ask back, what's wrong with market returns? They work pretty well.
Yeah, and
they don't necessarily work in the short run, but over time they've been pretty good.
Yeah, and the proper approach is to be well diversified, and to try to accumulate assets that aren't correlated with one another and create a real well diversified, to a large extent uncorrelated market and base a portfolio that captures the market's return, but the market in the broader sense. Because when we think about the market, we think about the S&P 500 or something like that. But why limit yourself to that, right? Everybody should have a little bit of real estate, a little bit. I mean, you should have if you have wealth, you should have a well-diversified portfolio where the stock market is one piece of a much broader thing. I don't know what's going on with my Facebook. Looks like it just disappeared. Is YouTube still there? Okay. I think is somebody on YouTube can you see me, Darius?
Yeah, everything's fine now.
Okay. Is somebody on YouTube? Yes. Okay. YouTube's still there. For some reason, it looks like Facebook went away. I don't know why. You know, it's just one of those, it varies over time. All right. Let's see. I've got a bunch of questions on the super chat. And then, Jennifer, if you have more questions, I'll go to you. Let me take these. Okay, let's see. What about Tesla? It's tax subsidized, but also market mover. Would it have succeeded without government? And if so, why did no other electric cars succeed? No, it wouldn't have succeeded without tax subsidies. Most electric car companies today have subsidies, or all of them, even the foreign ones, because they have tax subsidies overseas. But it's just before its time. Now, it could be that in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, if we all move to nuclear, that electricity prices would drop so much and battery technology would get so good that an electric car would make sense. So I'm not saying electric cars would never be successful in the marketplace. They could be successful in the marketplace when they're tried in the marketplace, when the marketplace develops them. But it's wrong, immoral, and inefficient to use government money to try to spur a market on. Because then, partially, you never know if a market would have developed it or not and whether it makes any sense or not. Because now you've got the Tesla. It's a cool car for all intents and purposes, right? Runs on coal, right? But it's a cool car. And would have been developed, wouldn't have been developed, when would have been developed, would have been profitable. Maybe it would have been developed as a car for rich people, you know, a toy for the rich for a while. Maybe, who knows what would have happened. Maybe it would have taken another 10 years before we had electric cars. I don't know. But I'm not a fan of Tesla. I think Elon Musk is a crony and uses every opportunity to use the government to improve his fate. And Tesla is a good example. He didn't have to do electric cars. He did it because of the subsidy. He didn't have to do solar panels. He did them before because of the subsidy. Now, again, somebody will say to you, but look, wonderful technology was developed. That's absolutely right. Sometimes government expenditures, I don't like to call them investments, result in positive outcomes. But you don't know what the alternative would have been. You don't know what that capital deployed in private hands would have produced. All you see is what happened. Like people say, what about NASA? What about NASA? You know, going to the moon produced a lot of good technology. It did. It did. Right? That was one project that doesn't seem like a complete and utter waste. But what would all of those billions of dollars done in the U.S. economy in the hands of private entrepreneurs? Would we be even richer with more technology than NASA developed if that money had been left in the hands of entrepreneurs? And of course, you can't just isolate that money. What if all the money that goes into basic research, the money that goes to universities, the money that goes to all these things, were left in the hands of private entrepreneurs? Wow, we'd be so much richer than we are today. So, yes. So I'm very much against government subsidizing any of these things. And Tesla, in that sense, is a bad company, in my view. Okay. How does objectivism differentiate between selfishness and narcissism? How do we defend objectivism from accusations of narcissism? I mean, quite easily, really. For objectivism, selfishness means use of one's mind to identify and ultimately act on those values that lead to a successful life long term. Now, there's nothing narcissistic about that. Use your mind, use reason to discover and act to achieve the values that are going to promote your life long term. It's not about instant gratification, because that's not the mind. If you thought about using the cocaine, you wouldn't use it. The reason people use cocaine is because they're narcissists or hedonists, and they want the instantaneous pleasure. Right? So there's nothing even remotely similar between selfishness and narcissism. They're not even closely related concepts. So what we have to emphasize when talking about selfishness is that it's your life, not moment, life, over the span of your whole life. And that the only way to achieve life, life as a human being, as Ayn Rand said, life qua man, is to use one's mind to think. And thinking means to be long-term, because thinking means to embody all the relevant facts, all the relevant facts that affect your life. Not right now, but over a lifespan. So again, that's how you differentiate. Narcissism is about the moment. Narcissism is about me looking good. It's about me appearing good. It doesn't even mean me being good. Right? Selfishness is about being good. Being good by using your mind, again, to identify and to pursue those values that are necessary to a successful life. All right? Do one of you guys want to follow up on that? Or? All right, you're good. Okay, this is from Ryan. It looks like from the UK, because he's giving money in pounds. I don't know what the dollar did today. I read Atlas Shrugged and I loved it. Mostly it was like preaching to the choir after listening to your lectures. Oh, so you listened to my lectures first and then read Atlas Shrugged. That's cool. You have radically changed my way of thinking. I'm very grateful to you. Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Ryan. I really appreciate hearing that. And that's why I do it, is because it seems like I have some people respond in that way. Okay, it says my internet connection is unstable. I don't know why it's unstable. One of the disadvantages, I guess, of living in Puerto Rico is internet is not the most stable in the world. All right, you guys can see me okay, hear me okay so far? So good. Okay. Ryan, I guess it's the same Ryan. Yeah, same Ryan. Asked, what's the picture over your left shoulder? And is there anything you and Ayn Rand would disagree on? So the picture over my left shoulder is, what's his name? All right, you can find the Jennifer. Do you know his name?
No.
All right, give me a moment. I'll find it because I know where to find it online. Okay. Let's see. Question, Jennifer.
Canada just recently made pot legal, and even if they only did it for the taxes, it's still better that it's legal, right?
Yes. So let me just say the painter is Brian Lawson. It is not Capoletti. The painter is Brian Lawson. It's not Lawson. It's Lawson. Let me you guys. It's Larsen. Brian Larsen. You can find his paintings on Cordair.com, Cordair.com. His name is Brian Lawson, Larsen. And the name of the painting, let's see if I can get you the name of the painting. But I think you'll want to go and look at his other paintings, because, I mean, there's a lot here. I own a few of the reproductions. Let's see. Yeah, I don't see the name. So I'll get back to you with the name. New Heights. Thank you, Greenish Blue. New Heights. That's the name of the painting. So but check out Brian Lawson on Cordair.com. is, I disagree on something. Look, I mean, it's a weird question, right? Because she was a genius, a once in a millennial genius. I'm smart, but I'm not super. You asked the question, Jennifer. I'll get back to you. I'm sorry. I'm not a genius. She was a philosopher. I'm not a philosopher. And I don't know of any errors in her philosophy. I don't know in her philosophy of anything that I disagree with.
Join the meeting.
Somebody join the meeting. Maybe they'll identify themselves in a minute. But I don't know anything in her philosophy that I disagree with. Right? And, you know, are there applications of a philosophy? I said, I'm not sure I agree with her about World War II. I'm sure there are other things like that that I might not. I'm not actually sure I agree with her about having a positive view of calling it nationalism. I don't know. I mean, I'd have to think about it. But nationalism having a positive connotation. So I'm sure there are other things in the concretes, in the application, not the concretes, that I would disagree with, but nothing philosophically. But then why would I? I mean, I'm not a philosopher. And it would be weird for me as a finance guy to disagree with Ayn Rand, the great genius of our time, in philosophy. I haven't discovered anything I disagree with. All right, Jennifer, you asked a question and I was out.
About pot being legalized?
Oh, pot. Yeah, absolutely. You know, one more freedom. The main thing about drug legalization, this is what differentiates me from, I guess, libertarians. I don't care about the users. I'm not that interested in users. Yeah, you want to smoke pot, that's fine. But I'm not like fighting for your right to smoke pot. I care about the corruption of the legal system, the police, the fact that pot, the fact that victimless crimes like taking drugs, and in particular pot, which is such a benign drug, completely distorts the legal system. It gets the cops chasing after people who they shouldn't be. It, I think, corrupts the cops because they know these people are not crooks. They're just users. So it's much more likely for them to get bribed in order to help with drug shipments or drug smuggling where they don't think it's that bad of a deal. But, of course, then it lands up them getting involved in all the, you know, drug fights and the murders and all of that. So, you know, I despise drugs. I don't particularly like people who use drugs, particularly anything harder than marijuana. But I like police, and I don't want the police to be distracted into spending most of their time going after non-criminals, going after people who are not, harming other people. So I would legalize all drugs, not just decriminalize them, legalize them all. Let them be sold at Walmart and, let the market deal with it. And if Walmart probably would say, we don't want to sell heroin, and that's fine. But, if people want to overdose and kill themselves, that's their problem. The other thing that would happen, I think it was the Economist, I'm terrible in names and my memory's not coming back. I keep thinking as I get older, my memory will get better, but it doesn't for some bizarre reason. I think it's biology, but reality. But I can see the guy's face. I can see the economist's face, but I can't remember his name. Anyway, a famous Chicago economist who won a Nobel Prize in economics said, I saw a talk that he gave and he said, one of the things that would happen if you legalize drugs would be there'd be a whole industry to get you off of the drugs, right? To cure your addiction. So people could try drugs without, or they would go on drugs and they could easily get off of them, which would save a lot of horrific conditions that people are on today, because the government is basically, and a few private clinics are basically the only people who are in the drug curing, but that's not the right term. What would be the term?
Rehab.
Drug rehabilitation. Because the government it's inefficient, it's not very productive, it's not, there's not a lot of investment in it. there's not a lot of money going into research into how to do it. But if it was privatized, if drugs were private, if drugs were legal, then you would have a whole industry that was dedicated to it. Just like as soon as people realized how bad tobacco was for them, you got tobacco patches and tobacco gum and all, and pills that you could take to get you off the addiction of tobacco. A whole industry came about to help people get off. The same thing would happen with drugs if we legalized them. So yes, I'm all for legalizing drugs. And in the meantime, if we could only legalize marijuana, that saves the police from going after marijuana dealers. They can now go after the criminals, the murderers, the thieves, then all the power to them. So I'm all for legalizing marijuana everywhere. All right. I'm out of Super Chat questions, unless somebody in the Super Chat wants to ask them. I'm out of emailed questions. Darius or Jennifer, do you have any questions, or should we call it a night?
Can I do one more?
Sure.
Do you think there's such a thing as having innate talent, like let's say to play the piano or something, or is it just practice?
So I don't believe it's just practice. And I know there's all kind of research that goes either way. But exactly what it is, I don't know, right? Now, there are people who say it's all practice and it's all how early in life you practice and so on. I just don't think that that's true. I think our brains are structured differently. There are areas in our brains we're born with that are different, that don't involve ideas, but do involve predispositions. So for example, I'm colorblind. I'm never going to be able to paint like an impressionist with the kind of colors, because I can't tell the difference between green and blue and red, or at least certain shades of green and blue and red. So, Mozart had an ability. Now, there are people who supposedly can explain Mozart away, but Mozart had this ability to remember and get kind of the music at a very young age. That part of his brain was somehow develop more. It's just like people are born with different IQs. They're born with different levels of intelligence. There's no question. Now, I don't think that's a static quantity. I don't think you're born with it and that's it. It's what you do with it and how you develop it. But we are born with different horsepower. I think you're also born with different capabilities, predispositions to music, to hand-eye coordination. I have no hand-eye coordination. So I can't draw. Because now I can get better. I'll give you this. I took drawing classes once just to prove that I couldn't draw under all circumstances. And the opposite was proven, because I actually drew okay for somebody who can't draw. And I took a class and I actually focused and I actually practiced and I did okay. But my wife could take a pencil and just like that, she draws 1,000 times better than even if I did 10,000 hours of. And she didn't practice, even when she was little, from a very young age. You can look at children's drawings and say, wow, huge difference. And it's not about one practiced more. So there are certain things. I think we know very little about these predispositions. This is part of my complaint about evolutionary psychology. This is kind of the stuff that they should be studying. And instead, they want to explain everything in terms of genes, everything in terms of programmed, instead of trying to differentiate, which I think is what's interesting. What is the consequence of reason and free will? What is truly predisposition? What's the relationship between the two? Clearly, practice matters a lot. My guess is there are a million Mozarts, but only one or two practice. Only one or two have a father like Mozart who gets them to practice the way he did, or that orients them towards the music. So there's no question there's a huge, there's a lot of people that might be born with a certain disposition, but what does it take to develop it? Those are the interesting questions, I think, in the intersection between evolution and psychology, which is not being studied as far as I know, but which would be interesting from an evolutionary psychology perspective to study. But instead, they want to explain everything in terms of genes. Part of the problem with anybody in any field is they think their field is the most important. They love their field, and then they want to use their field to explain everything. I know economists who think philosophy is bonk, psychology is bonk, All these sociology is bunk. Everything is bunk. The only thing that matters is economics. And you can use economics to explain everything. That same economist I mentioned about drugs has a whole book about how economics can explain marriage. Your marriage is completely driven by economic incentives, he would argue, right? So it's no psychology, no philosophy, no ideas. It's just economic incentives. And then I know, so you're an evolutionary psychologist. Yeah, there's something important there to study. Instead, you want to explain everything. Nothing else matters except your genes. And this is what happens, and it's sad, and it's unfortunate, because I think we lose out on real knowledge, on interesting knowledge. Somebody quotes, Mozart once said, it's love that's the root of genius, and somebody else says Mozart was wrong. Not really. He wasn't that wrong. I mean, there's no question in my mind that a passion and a love for something is necessary in order to excel at that something. In, you know, and this is why I don't think it's all about IQ. I think it's what you do with the IQ. And if you can combine whatever it is you're good at with the love, and which means the passion, but the love, a deep love, not just a momentary passion, but a real love of the thing, that's when you manifest in genius, right? I don't think you can manifest yourself as a genius without the love of the field that you're engaging in. Anyway, my speculation. And of course you have to practice as well, but I know people who practice and they never get better. And I know people who practice and get better. And part of the reason, some of it's the inclination and in a sense of talent, but part of it is the love. If you practice with love, you will get much, much, much better, much, much, much faster than if you practice without the love. Okay, two questions and then maybe we'll be done. Avid Film Buff asks, why is Giuliani a bad guy? I know nothing of him. Well, it's hard if you know nothing of him to kind of give a quick reason why Giuliani's a bad guy. But Giuliani is one of my least favorite people on the planet. And primarily because Giuliani, in the 1980s, took the job of, he left the Justice Department. He was the number two person in the Justice Department under Reagan. And he left in order to become the district attorney for the Southern District of New York. Now, if anybody's seen the TV show Billions, everybody should see the TV show Billions. It's a must-see, because the TV show Billions portrays a power-lusting, evil district attorney in the Southern District of New York. In other words, it portrays Giuliani. Giuliani took the position because he viewed it as a political stepping stone. He was a power-lusting bastard. I can't say enough bad things about him. And his job was to put as many Wall Street people in jail as he could, because he realized that if you put people in jail, then Wall Street people in jail, he would play into the hatred of Wall Street that everybody has, and that would promote his political career, which indeed it did. And he would arrest people at their offices, handcuff them at their desk. These are finance guys, right? What are they going to do? You're going to handcuff them at the desk. March them out, leak it in advance to the newspapers. So he would have the cameras and the reporters outside the building as he walked with these guys out. It also turns out that years afterwards, many of the prosecutions, I suspect most, were overturned on appeal. So most of the people are not even guilty, even by the standards of the subjective law that we have today regulating finance. And then on top of that, I think it was Giuliani who is the first person to use RICO statutes. RICO statutes are statutes that were designed to go after organized crime. And what they allow you to do is to freeze somebody's assets before they are found guilty. So when they're just, you know, accused of a crime, you freeze their assets. Think about what happens to a financier whose assets are frozen and they're arrested for something. Well, their career is finished. Everything is finished. And what do they live on? Their business is destroyed. You've taken the asset away. And he destroyed businessman after businessman after businessman It was just horrific. And his primary target, the person, he always said, I'm arresting these guys because through them I want to get to this ultimate target. And the ultimate target is Michael Milken, who I believe is one of the great heroes of American capitalism. I believe is one of the greatest financiers in American history. I believe is the guy who almost single-handedly saved the American economy in the 1980s. And he, Giuliani was after Michael Milken. He was going to get him. And in the end, he did. Now, he wasn't district attorney in the Southern District of New York anymore, but it was his people. It was his agenda. He laid the groundwork, and he destroyed Mike Milken, which I think we're still painful to this day because the U.S. economy hurt when Mike Milken wasn't around. There's a lot of stuff that happened. I could go on and on and on about this, but now that's chapter one of my hatred. Then, of course, he ran for mayor of New York, and all the investment banks who were competitors to Mike Milken thanked Giuliani for destroying Mike Milken by supporting his campaign and funding him. So he's funded by all the guys who survived after Drexel Burnham, which was Mike Milken's firm, went under in 1989. And he ultimately became mayor of New York. And when he was mayor of New York, he cleaned up the city. He gets a lot of credit for that. But he did it using fascist tactics, eminent domain like crazy, taking over neighborhoods, telling people what they couldn't do, what stores they couldn't open, micromanaging the city. And again, sometimes what government does appears to be positive, but what we miss is the human cost. What we miss is the human cost. It's the rights that were violated in order to get there. Yes, New York is a more pleasant place to live today, but man, did a lot of people have to be rolled over in order to get to this point. What about their rights? What about their New York? All right, let's see. We still got two questions because they keep coming. What are your views on cryptocurrency? I've stated my views in the past. I don't actually believe cryptocurrency would exist as a currency in a free market. I think a free market currency would always be backed by something solid, something real like gold. So I don't think cryptocurrency would exist ultimately in a true free market. I think cryptocurrency gets most of its value from the ability to engage in anonymous transactions mostly for illegal purposes and to move money around, again, usually for illegal purposes, like getting capital out of China, which is illegal, not wrong, just illegal. And that has value, and therefore cryptocurrencies have some value, but probably not as much as some people think they have. I think what's really interesting, and I'm not going to go into details, but what I think is really interesting is the technology behind cryptocurrencies, the blockchain, which I think has millions of applications, has lots of ways it's going to impact the world around us. But exactly how, exactly who, at what its relationship of blockchain to cryptocurrencies in particular or crypto something, I'm not sure. I'm not an expert. And I think we need to let the market grow and evolve. And we'll see. In 10, 15 years, I think we'll know a lot more about the efficacy of blockchain and cryptocurrency than we know today. Okay, the one place where objectivism abandons reason in exchange for a faith-like belief is when it comes to free will. That's just silly, because you cannot have reason without free will. There is no such thing as reason without free will. Reason means nothing if one doesn't choose, if one doesn't, select between options and select to engage with reality. That's not reason. Then it's just you're just a computer, and there's a dramatic difference, not a small difference, between you and a computer. We are conscious beings who have control over the functioning of our own mind. We have a control over the functioning. And of course, it's not based on faith, because I experience free will. I observe free will. Free will is something that I can introspect. And introspect is no different than my senses. That would be like you're accepting on faith that the microphone is in front of you because you see it with your eyes. But it could be a delusion. It could be a fake microphone. Your eyes could be deceiving you. I mean, that's all nonsensical. You could be in the matrix. You could be in a vat, a brain in a vat, and none of this is real. All of that is arbitrary. Introspection. I see this microphone. The microphone is. It's existent. I can observe free will. If I observe free will, I observe myself choosing. My response is not, oh, that must be some confusion. That must be. No. My response is, that's interesting. And if science says something about it, great. But the fact is, I'm observing it. So it is. So science cannot overturn free will. Free will is an axiomatic concept. And if you don't get free will as an axiomatic concept, then you don't get objectivism. Just like existence exists is an axiomatic is an axiom. I can't prove it, but everything I do depends on it. And just like when Sam Harris talks about the choices he makes and the choices we have and being moral, he's assuming free will. He can't deny free will and assert choice and assert morality. Choice and morality assume that someone is choosing and has a choice to make. All right, I think we're gonna wrap it up. I know there's was another question. We'll take it next time. It's late. It's 1:20 into it. And thanks, Darius. Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks all of you for participating. Thanks to all of you who did the super chat. If you want to be where Darius and Jennifer are, you can by contributing on Patreon, $100 or more a month, and being supporters of the Iran Book Show at that level. That is one of the perks you get. So please, those of you who can afford it and who value the program enough at that level, then please do so. Thank you, Darius and Jennifer, for valuing the program that much. And please share. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel. And, of course, those of you who have not yet become sponsors of the show on, Patreon or PayPal, please do so. Patreon.com, Iran Book Show, /Iran Book Show, PayPal.me/Iran Book Show. And we will be on again tomorrow. You see how much value you get for the money? You're getting a lot of Iran Book Show this week. We're going to be back tomorrow with Amy Peacock for the Iran and Amy Show. I'll see you all there. Let your friends know. Get other people to participate. And have a great week. Bye, everybody. Bye, Darius. Bye, Jennifer.
Bye. Thank you.